time. He's 88 and frail, and his lawyer today said he would appeal. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Berlin.
President Obama meets today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who remains unapologetic about building new apartments in East Jerusalem. Palestinians see that as another threat to the Mideast peace process. Netanyahu tells a pro-Israel group in Washington the U.S. cannot force a peace agreement. He says Jerusalem isn't a settlement, that it is Israel's capital. New research confirms that substituting so-called good fat, polyunsaturated fat in vegetable oils, for animal fat in meat, butter, and cheese is better for heart health than eating no fat at all. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Starbucks, whose coffee of the week is Starbucks Red East Africa Blend. Learn more at Starbucks, a partner of Red, working to help fight AIDS in Africa.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Starting Thursday, April 1st, you will be able to hear Morning Edition weekdays from 6 to 9 on WILL-FM. Please tune in weekdays beginning Thursday, April 1st on WILL-FM.
It's NPR News for more of Central Illinois, beginning April 1st on 90.9 FM.
AM 580 will continue to bring you Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus 580 archives, so as you listen, do keep in mind, we'll not be taking your calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be bringing you the story of three scholars and one freshman who all crossed paths at Harvard University in the early 1960s. This was the winter of 60-61. And the people that we're talking about are Timothy Leary, Houston Smith, Richard Alpert, later to be known as Ram Dass, and Andrew Weil, someone who is now well known for talking about writing about health. We now know him as Dr. Andrew Weil, but he was not a physician at the time. We're talking this morning with Don Latin, who writes about these men in a recently published book, which is titled The Harvard Psychedelic Club. He writes that these men came together at what was an extraordinary time and place in American history, and their experiences in a drug research project certainly changed their lives, but it also ended up changing much of American culture as well. The book has just recently been published by Harper. HarperCollins is out now in the bookstores, and it's an interesting story, so you might want to take a look at it. Just a little bit more about our guest. He is one of the nation's leading journalists covering alternative and mainstream religious movements and figures in America. His work has appeared in many magazines and newspapers. He's also worked as a consultant and commentator for television programs Dateline, Primetime, Good Morning America, Nightline, Anderson Cooper 360, the PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. He's author of a number of other books. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455, and email. So if you'd like to email your question, that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Latin, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
I think it's a fascinating book, which may tell you something about me, the fact that I find it fascinating. And I know that the book's gotten a lot of attention. I know you've talked about the fact that you've now written several books, and this has gotten more attention than anything else that you have written. And it makes me wonder, I think I know the answer, but it makes me wonder why. Why do you think that people are so fascinated by it?
Well, yeah, it has gotten a lot of attention. I got a great New York Times review and lots of radio shows and newspaper reviews. And I don't know. I think that people are still fascinated with the 1960s, especially the really early 1960s. And one of my favorite shows on TV is that show Mad Men, which is about advertising copywriters and executives in this exact same period, the early 1960s. And it was really a cusp. I mean, it was so much, there were so many just incredible social, spiritual, psychological, sexual changes going on in the society in those few years from the late 50s into the mid-1960s. And I think it's a time that people are really fascinated with. And I'm actually glad that the book has gotten such a great reception. I was a little worried that younger people might say, oh, no, you know, not another book about the 60s, right? I mean, enough. Because this is actually 50 years ago. These events started to unfold 50 years ago, which someone like me, the baby boom generation, kind of boggles my mind. It makes me feel ancient. But, we're closer to 2060 than we are to 1960 this year. That's the turning point right now, 2010. But I think these four characters are another reason the book's gotten so much attention. I mean, Timothy Leary was such an iconic and divisive figure of that decade, 60s and the 70s. And Houston Smith has been very popular, sold a lot of books about the world's religions, and he's really done a lot to help people understand other faiths. So he's a major character, I think, especially in religious studies. Of course, Andrew Weil, as you mentioned, is kind of the CEO of alternative medicine in America now, Mr. Natural. And he starts out as kind of the villain in the story, but I think redeems himself in the end. And then, of course, there's Richard Appert, who went on to go off to India, famously, and then later in the 60s and return as Ram Dass and be one of the seminal spiritual teachers of my generation. So I think there's still a lot of interest in these four characters.
Now, I think that it seems that a lot of the interest or the reaction to the book maybe breaks down along generational lines, or at least in the sense that I think you're going to, if you had lived through it or were peripheral to it, I was just a little late to the party, but I think I can definitely relate to the subject matter. If you lived through it, I think you're going to have one reaction. And if you didn't, and as you said, we're talking about 50 years since the initial events here, there were a lot of people who didn't live through it. And I think for a lot of them, they say, what's the big deal? Who cares? Or why should I care? And I think maybe they fail to appreciate features of life today in America and American culture that maybe we don't really think very much about, because depending on how old you are, you might think, well, they've always been there. Well, right. They haven't always been there. And this time that we're talking about really, and these people are really responsible for a lot of our attitudes about the mind, about spirituality, about psychology, a lot of things now that have really become woven in the fabric of American life.
Yes, that's definitely the case. Some people might be, young people might wonder about this. One of the things that's been heartening for me is that there is a lot of, I go to book readings, and there are quite a few younger people. We also have a Facebook page, a fan page, and there's almost 1,000 fans now. Most of them, or a lot of them, are younger people. But I think you're right. We don't see, not just younger people, even people of the baby boom generation, older people don't really see the effect that not just these four men, but the whole psychedelic counterculture of the 50s has had on the culture today. And by looking at these four individuals, you can kind of chart that. I mean, Andrew Weil is one example. He says that the experiences that he had on mescaline, peyote, LSD, psilocybin, other psychedelic drugs back in the 60s and 70s changed the way he thought about the relation between mind, body, and spirit, that what happens in your mind can actually have a physical effect on your body. And he went on, I mean, right after he graduated in 1964 as an undergraduate, he went on to Harvard Medical School, and, you know, he became an MD. And he started writing about and lecturing about alternative medicine very early on in the early 70s. And, you know, this whole idea of alternative medicine, I mean, some people will kind of write it off as, you know, magical thinking or pseudoscience. But the fact is, it's not hard to find, say, a doctor today who will prescribe meditation to a cardiac patient. This is something that didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago. People are understanding the positive effects that meditation can have. And so that's one example. I think the whole, when we look at healthcare, and Andrew Weil has been a proponent for, I think, the real reformation of the American medical system of health care reform, not just how it's paid for, but more preventative care and more focus on health and well-being. And there's a lot of reasons why this has developed, but I think one of them is these counterculture values of the 60s.
Yeah. And also, for you, there's a kind of a personal tie-in. You do talk about some of your own experiences, something that apparently you wrestled with whether or not you even wanted to include them. And I think that you would say that your interest in spirituality, perhaps you can trace it back to this time or around this time, and that maybe if that hadn't happened to you, if you hadn't gone through that, you wouldn't have ended up being a journalist specializing in writing about religion.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a part of my life. I struggled about whether to include my story in this book, not because I have any trouble talking about it or I'm embarrassed or ashamed of it or anything, but because the book is not about me. It's about these four guys, and I didn't want to get in the way of the story. I mean, I'm a journalist, so it's kind of a new territory for me to be writing about myself. But I did do that at the end and afterward. I wrote about, you know, some of the experiences that I had on LSD in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, as a high school student and as an undergraduate in college. And, you know, I had incredible, profound, revelatory experiences. Then I also had, you know, the bad trip from central casting of mine. I had some really bad experiences, which led to some psychological problems, which went on for a few months in my life, and it was a difficult time in my life. So I've seen both the ecstasy and the agony that these drugs can produce, and I say that in part because I'm not recommending that people go out and take LSD in a haphazard manner or necessarily at all. I mean, it's up to the individual, of course, but these drugs can be dangerous psychologically. You know, plus, they're illegal, so you have to watch out what you're doing here. But in my case, you know, in the long run, I think my experiences on psychedelic drugs, well, I know for a fact they got me interested in finding kinder, gentler ways to explore my own heart and mind, this territory that we can see so, you know, so spectacularly sometimes on psychedelics. So I got interested in Buddhism and meditation, you know, as a young man. And I think one of the reasons I became a religion reporter was because I was both kind of fascinated and a bit fearful of the mystical state. And it was a great job for me to have, kind of a perch by which to talk about other people's experiences, you know, not just on drugs, but in all kinds of different religious movements. Yeah. So it's definitely had an impact on my life, and I think on a lot of other people's lives, too.
Our guest in this hour, Don Lattin. He's one of the nation's leading journalists covering alternative and mainstream religious movements and figures in America. He's the author of several books. His newest is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, and it's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. It's out now in the bookstore. You want to find it, you certainly can. Questions are welcome. We do have somebody here to bring into the conversation, and of course we'll talk some more about definitely want to talk about these four men and how they came together, the subject of the book. Questions, though, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I have a champagne caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a few comments I want to make, and since I haven't read your book, I don't know to the extent you deal with these. I want to talk first about a precursor person to this is Aldous Huxley and his Heaven and Hell and Doors of Perception book, where he talks about his own experiences with mescaline, etc., and connects it to his writing on the perennial philosophies, which of course Houston Smith picks up on, and Ram Dass does too. And then, so I wondered if, and then of course there's William James who connects with that, but I'll see who's a Harvard person. And then there's also the direction afterwards, where you have, at least in America, the, and I don't know if you're aware of this, a number of Buddhist, let me call them masters, two that I know of is Soen Nakagawa Roshi and Trungpa, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, both of whom I knew, and both of whom given acid or other substances as experimental and essentially their responses, reactions to these And, of course, this links up in part with Houston Smith, who's also connected to various Zen teachers, though in Japan. And Ram Dass, of course, has connections with Trungpa and with some other people who I need not mention at this point. But I just wondered if you connected any of that with your writings and research, or whether that's all new territory for you.
Yeah, well, that's quite a lot. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, no, well, those are great questions. And, yes, I definitely connect all of those things very much in the book. Huxley is a major part of the book. Huxley happened to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the exact time this all started. He was delivering a series of lectures at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at MIT in the fall of 1960. He was actually brought there by Houston Smith, who knew him from back in the 40s, from before Huxley ever took mescaline or wrote Doors of Perception or The Perennial Philosophy. And Huxley is a major character. I mean, I write in the book that you can, if you really want to trace this back, the sort of the birth of the psychedelic 60s, you really need to start, I mean, at the earliest with Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, which was published in 1954. But anyway, Huxley was around, and Huxley met with Leary. Huxley met with Leary actually on the very day that John F. Kennedy was elected president in November of 1960. And he wasn't sure what to make of Leary. At first, he was hopeful that Leary could, you know, help continue this psychedelic drug exploration. But later, fairly soon, Huxley got a little frustrated with Leary, thought he was a bit of a, well, he actually called him an ass, word he used, but called him, Leary was something of a megalomaniac and sort of had a messianic complex. And a lot of people, including Huxley and Houston Smith, saw that. So, yeah, Huxley is definitely part of this. Huxley is the one who gave Leary the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which Leary used as the sort of blueprint for his book we co-wrote with Ralph Metzner and Richard Alpert, The Psychedelic Experience, which was a guidebook to how to take LSD. So Huxley is definitely very much part of this story. And you also mentioned William James, who was, you know, the father of American psychology and was at Harvard. And, yes, definitely, Leary saw himself in the tradition of William James and used James as his defense when they were trying to kick him out of Harvard, which they successfully did, which is a big part of my book, is what really happened at Harvard with Huxley, with Leary and Alpert. So, yeah, both those gentlemen are definitely a big part of the story.
Yeah. Anything you want to say about the other question that the caller raised?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, you mentioned two Buddhist teachers. One was Trungpa Rinpoche, who after Alpert went to India and became Ram Dass, he met a teacher there, Neem Karoli Baba, who became his guru, and he came back here as one of his disciples. And when he died, for a while, Alpert went under the wing of Trungpa Rinpoche and was working with him very closely for a few years, but that actually didn't continue. But a lot of meditation masters had weren't too enthralled with the whole idea of psychedelic drugs. I mean, some would say you might get an experience from them, but then what do you do with the experience? And that's what I write about this in the book too. That the experience, yeah, we can have incredible experiences on these drugs, but the important question is, what do we do with the experience? How do we bring that into the rest of our lives? And how does that make us a better person, or a more aware person, more compassionate person? So I think a lot of the people went from the drugs to these different Buddhist teachers later on in the 60s and 70s.
Well, I want to thank the caller. Invite others, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. The people that you talk about here, particularly the four men, Leary, Alpert, Houston Smith, Andy Weil, are certainly larger than life figures or become such. But the one of all of them who is the larger than life figure certainly is Timothy Leary, someone who I think perhaps in time the other men managed to achieve a lot of things, or at least become more mainstream. Leary, I think, was always just kind of most famous for being Timothy Leary. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that this man who really emerges as the ultimate outsider was anything but when he started out in the 1950s, he was a mainstream psychologist and became, through personal experience, became interested in psychedelics. And he genuinely thought that these things would be, as people have often reacted to such substances, would be miracle drugs. And that they would change psychiatry, they would save the world. And he was on a mission, and it wasn't about recreation. It was about therapeutic applications.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Leary was a rising star in mainstream kind of clinical psychology. I mean, he was always a bit of an outsider in some sense of the word, but he published a book on personality assessment in the late 1950s, which was very well received. He had a lot to do with setting up the psychology department out here in the West Coast at Kaiser Hospital, which became Kaiser Permanente, one of the major healthcare providers in the country now. So he was definitely, you know, establishment mainstream character. He was in Mexico on vacation. He was on a 3-year appointment at Harvard. He was in the summer 1960. He was in Mexico, and he was given some of these mushrooms. A friend of his, actually Frank Barron, a colleague of his back at Berkeley and at Harvard, Frank Barron basically turned Leary onto these mushrooms. And Leary had this, he called it the most profound religious experience of his life on psilocybin mushrooms, on magic mushrooms. And like you mentioned, he came back to Harvard on fire, I mean, just from day one. And he was convinced that, I mean, he was questioning the value of psychotherapy and especially of behavioralism, B.F. Skinner, which was the reigning philosophy at Harvard at the time. And he was convinced that psychedelic drugs were going to revolutionize psychology and then change the world. And so he immediately started this project called the Harvard Psilocybin Project, where he gave psilocybin, actually a synthesized form of the psilocybin, so you can control the dose, to a lot of graduate students, and then to various people. He did a project at a prison where he tried to see if psychedelic drugs could be used to change the way prisoners think and reduce the recidivism rate. They gave psilocybin to seminary students from Andover Newton Seminary in the Boston area to see if these experiences that people having were, quote, authentic religious experiences. That's actually why they brought Houston Smith into the Harvard Psychedelic Club, was kind of as a theological consultant. They needed someone who knew about religion and mysticism. And Leary and Alpert didn't know anything about this. They didn't expect to have these kind of spiritual experiences. They were surprised. And so they brought people like Huxley and more so Houston Smith into the fold to try to figure all this out.
And that's, again, good we can connect it, as the earlier caller raised the question, raised the name of Aldous Huxley, connected again. Apparently, they, Alpert and Leary, really wanted to get Huxley involved in this project, and he had other things to do, or for whatever reason, he said, no, but I got this other guy for you.
Right.
Houston Smith.
Yeah, it was late in Huxley's life. I mean, I mentioned that Leary met Huxley the day Kennedy was elected. Huxley died about 1,000 days later on the very day that Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And shortly before he died, Huxley's wife, Laura, his second wife, Laura Huxley, gave him an injection of LSD as he was dying to usher him into the next life. And the man who brought the LSD out a few days before to the West Coast to Huxley was Timothy Leary.
Yeah. Smith, you've managed to spend some time talking with all of the principals in the story that are still around. Leary's not with us anymore, but Alpert or Ram Dass and Houston Smith and Andrew Weil certainly are. Houston Smith is 90, and you talked to him about this time when he dropped acid New Year's Day 1961 at Timothy Leary's house. And, you know, even though he might have had some doubts about this whole project and about what this experience was all about, but truly now 50 years after it happened, this experience stayed with him.
It does. Houston is a wonderful man. As you mentioned, he's 90 years old now. He lives in Berkeley. He actually came to a reading that I had in Berkeley and spoke, which was fantastic. And yeah, I interviewed him. Well, I interviewed him 4 or 5 times over the years, and was a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, but had a long interview with him, series of interviews with him and his wife, Kendra, for the book. And when It wasn't LSD. It was actually psilocybin, which was the drug that he took initially. And yeah, it was. He met Leary at his house on New Year's Day, 1961, for his first psychedelic trip. And when Houston Smith talks about this, you know, his eyes light up like a little kid. You know, and he says, "Oh, Don, what a way to start the '60s." but that first trip of his, actually, it was more terrifying than enlightening. I mean, he had, in some ways, you could call it a bad trip. I mean, he had a lot of fear. He thought he was going to die, or that his body would, he couldn't come back and inhabit his body. And he had a really tough time. And Leary actually was afraid that he had a real bad trip, and he was alienated Houston Smith. But actually, Houston did see the other side of this and was just fascinated by the psychological and kind of mystical experiences that he had on the drug. So he was very, very closely involved with Leary and Alpert for the first year or two, and then he split off.
Apparently, eventually, things got a little bit too wild.
Yes, yeah, so he was. He was an ordained Methodist. Still is an ordained Methodist minister. Not that he was really that conservative. He wasn't. I mean, he was also worked very closely back into the 40s and 50s with the Vedanta Society, which was a Hindu and a missionary society from India. So Houston had been meditating and doing yoga, and he was already quite a character for that time. But he'd never really had what he considered, like, or had read about and interviewed people, like a full-blown mystical experience. I mean, he'd meditated, he'd had little, you know, glimpses of something, but never had, you know, the full experience. And that's why he wanted to try these drugs for himself. Plus, like I mentioned, Leary and Alpert wanted his expertise about religion and mysticism.
Our guest in this hour, Don Lattin, is a journalist who specializes in covering alternative and mainstream religious movements and figures in America. His work has appeared in many U.S. magazines and newspapers, including the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covered the religion beat for almost 20 years. He's also been a consultant and commentator for a number of television programs, Dateline, Primetime, Good Morning America, Nightline, also the PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. He's the author of several books, and his most recent is the book that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. It's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. Now, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I want to get to the Andrew Weil story here, because I think what you argue is the one piece of this that truly is new that nobody had written about before.
Right.
This happened while was there at Harvard. He was a student, and a friend of his got involved in the project, this was something that. And he shouldn't have been, because he was an undergraduate.
Right,
and,
right.
And Alpert and Leary had promised that they would only be using grad students in this. But apparently there were a few undergrads. One of them was a friend of Andrew Weil's. And Andrew Weil was, playing it flat out, he was jealous because he didn't get to play. And so he decided that he was going to take down Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert.
Right, right. Yeah, what happened is Andrew Weil was a whole generation younger than the other three men I'm writing about here. And he was an undergraduate at Harvard, and he had a friend named Ronnie Winston, who was the son of Harry Winston of the Harry Winston Diamond Jewelry Company designers, very, very wealthy, prominent East Coast family. So anyway, Ronnie and Andy volunteered to be research subjects, but were told by Leary and Alpert that they had agreed to only use graduate students, not undergraduates, as research subjects. So actually, they went on and got their own supply of mescaline and did their own undergraduate version of the grown-ups research project at their dorm at Harvard. So they were doing that. They found out another way to find the drugs. But what happened is maybe almost a year later, Ronnie Winston was at a party and met Richard Alpert, and they became very close friends. Professor Alpert turned on Ronnie Winston, led him in some self-exploratory psilocybin sessions, and even admits that he had something of a romantic attraction to Ronnie Winston. Richard Alpert was a gay man living in the closet at the time, and talks about his whole struggles with his sexuality in the book as well. But anyway, they just basically became very good friends and sort of a mentoring relationship. And Ronnie Winston was brought into the fold, along with other undergraduates as well. But so Andrew Weil was not. They didn't trust Andrew Weil, Lirian Alpert. And he was, on the one hand, he was jealous. On the other hand, maybe he thought they were getting a little carried away in their with their research protocol, because this thing was quickly morphing into something other than a research project. It was the beginning of the 60s counterculture, and some people thought it was a drug cult that was forming around Lirian and Alpert. So Weil decided to take them down, and he did it in the following manner. He had been writing a little bit for the Harvard Crimson, the student newspaper at Harvard. He proposed an investigation to prove that they were in, that Lirian and Alpert were in fact using undergraduates as research subjects. None of the undergraduates would admit this publicly or testify or tell the university this, because they were part of the family. They liked what was going on. We thought this was important research. And so what Weil did is he went to Ronnie Winston, his father, Harry Winston, and said, "Your son is taking these drugs against university regulations with a professor at Harvard. And if he doesn't admit it to the Harvard administration, we're going to put his name in the paper as part of this drug scandal." Well, this is, like I said, a very prominent family. They did not want to be implicated in this drug scandal. So Harry Winston put pressure on his son, Ronnie, to go to the president of Harvard's office and spill the beans. And so he was called in, Ronnie Winston was called into the office of Nathan Pusey, the president of Harvard, and asked, "Son, did Professor Alpert give you these drugs?" And Ronnie paused and said, "Well, yes, sir, he did, and it was the most educational experience I've had at Harvard." "Well, we don't care about that. Thank you very much." You know, so that, but that was the evidence they had that they used to fire Alpert, who, while he didn't have tenure yet, he was on tenure track and definitely was going to get tenure. And so the deal was the Harvard administration gave the exclusive rights to the story. They tipped off, you know, the day before they actually fired Richard Alpert, they told the Crimson, and the Crimson had the story, broke the story. And it was a big page one story in the Crimson with an editorial, just a vicious editorial, attacking Lirian Alpert as like a virus infecting the campus community, I mean, words like that, and called them quacks, not scientists. I mean, really vicious stuff. And the next day it was front page of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And Lirian Alpert were kicked out of Harvard and thrust into the national spotlight as the sort of dynamic duo to lead the psychedelic crusade for the rest of the 60s.
And just sort of to round this out, because you talked about this with Andrew Weil, that Andrew Weil is not proud of what he did. He's not happy about it. He has apologized apparently more than once over the years to the people who were involved. You know, so he said, "Look, I was just a kid. Yeah, I shouldn't have done that." And somehow everybody's kind of dealt with this, although you've also talked about it with Ram Dass, and he's still pretty angry about it.
There's still some hard feelings. It's amazing, you know. Yeah, you're right. Andrew Weil is not proud of what he did, and I think Leary did forgive him before he died. I mean, they even, you know, worked together a little bit. Richard Alpert still has trouble just because of the way he went about this, the way Weil went about this. And, you know, it's sort of, I mean, he didn't actually out Richard Alpert as a gay man, but he wrote some other things that were, he would say that they were like rumors of homosexual relationships, and it was obvious that he was talking about Alpert. So, you know, this was the early 60s. So, you know, people were in the closet then. And so there are still some hard feelings. I mean, Andrew Weil has even, put on a fundraiser to help Ram Dass with some of his medical bills. They've publicly kissed and made up. But there's still some hard feelings from Ram Dass's part. Although he's basically put it behind him, I think.
Yeah, all right. We have a number of callers here. We're moving on to our last 15 minutes, so I want to get in as many callers as I can, but callers will really help us by trying to keep their questions and comments as brief as they can. That way we can get in as many as we can. So we'll take them in the order they came in. First in line is someone in Whiteheath, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm just curious, do you have anything in your book about their adventures in Mexico? Because we stayed at a resort that they were at on the beach in Zihuatanejo. Mm-hmm. We go there every year, and there's always these talk about Timothy Leary and his people doing experiments with the LSD down there at that beach. Do you do do you talk about that issue at all?
Yes. There's a whole chapter in the book called Trouble in Paradise.
Oh, okay.
Where I talk about, that's the first place they landed after they were kicked out of Harvard. Actually, they'd already, in the summer before they got kicked out of Harvard, they were running these seminars out of the Hotel Catalina.
Yes, that's where we stay.
Yeah, in Zihuatanejo. You were there. And so when they got kicked out of Harvard, their original plan was to set up shop on a permanent basis in Zihuatanejo, just near Acapulco.
Uh-huh.
And they were chased out by the Mexican federales, under pressure from the U.S. government, the CIA.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, Richard Nixon, later on, this is before Nixon, but Richard Nixon would call Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America, and to which Leary replied, oh, yeah, well, I have America surrounded. But the classic Timothy Leary line. Uh-huh. But no, the government was, the U.S. government was really out to get these guys. They saw them as very dangerous. So Leary and Alpert were chased out of Mexico. They went to Antigua and the Dominican Republic, or Dominica for a while. They were chased out of those countries. They used to like to say they were kicked out of one university in three countries in 6 months in 1963. And then they wound up at a place called Millbrook, a big estate in upstate New York, where they kind of settled in for the next few years, and that was where they did a lot of their work.
All right, so you have a chapter. Well, I'll have to look up the book.
Yeah, there's a whole section on Zihuatanejo. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well,
thanks.
Thank you. Let's go next. We'll talk with someone in St. Joe. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Time is short, so I'll just make it real quick and listen off air. Wanted to get a little philosophical, what you gentlemen were talking about in the beginning of the show, the actual era, early 60s, 60, 61, so on and so forth. I was just wondering, from the author's point of view, was it inevitable that that time was going to happen? In other words, we were in a bit of prosperity, awful lot of baby boomers coming in, going to college, kind of a unique period. Was it inevitable that the 60s, the early 60s were going to come about? And was wondering, do you think there'll ever be a period like that again in our future? I look at it. I'm interested. I'm like David. I was 5 years old in 1960, so I kind of came late to the dance. But I'm interested in the period itself, and I just find it so unique. Kennedy administration, the space program, so on and so forth. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, there were, you know, sometimes when you're talking about a book, you can overstate the case, and you know, obviously there were a lot of reasons why the 60s became the 60s, and these four guys were just part of it. But I think they were an important part of it. As you mentioned, there was the whole post-war economic boom. There was this demographic bulge of people all coming, the baby boomers coming of age at the same time. It was a unique, that was all in some ways unique in American history. Who knows whether it'll happen again? Probably not exactly like that. But there was, you mentioned Kennedy. I mean, this all happened at Harvard. Kennedy, you know, was a Harvard man himself, senator of Massachusetts. And there was a whole feeling in the country. I mean, I was young at the time then, too. I was not that much old. I'm not that much older than you are. But I remember that there was a whole feeling of kind of hope and optimism, and there was a real sense that something was changing when Kennedy was elected, at least for a year or two, a bit like we felt, some people felt with Barack Obama, you know, right after he was elected. It was a similar kind of a feeling. So, you know, hope and change and all that was in the air, too. It didn't last too long in either case, those feelings, but it was an extraordinary time. And there's a lot of other things going on in the 60s, obviously. But the psychedelic drug movement was more important than people, I think, give it credit for. I think it had something to do with people getting interested in environmentalism and ecology, some of the insights people had on psychedelic drugs in terms of their relationship with nature. I mentioned, healthcare, religion and spirituality. I haven't really talked about that, but people call themselves spiritual but not religious these days. A lot of people do. Well, I think I argue in the book, the work of Houston Smith and Ram Dass has a lot to do with that as well. So I think it's a fascinating period to study.
All right, very well. Let's go next to Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi, thanks. I wondered if you talked to the surviving people about their feelings about the fact that the CIA and the MK Ultra was also investigating the use of psychedelics, and how problematic that probably was for them. But the other thing is, wasn't there a fourth guy? I'm having a hard time summing his names. I know that he sort of kept his head down and wasn't as high profile, but he did lecture around the country a little bit. He was looking into yoga, kundalini yoga, especially as another way of transcending, as it were, I guess. And I guess I'll hang up and listen on the phone here momentarily, if I could.
All right, sure.
Okay, well, you mentioned first the CIA. Yeah, the CIA and the Army did lots of experiments with LSD excuse me, in the 1950s, and some of it was at Harvard. Actually, the guy who wanted to become the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, was a subject in some CIA-funded research in the 1950s. There's a whole book that was written about this, which didn't get much attention, called Harvard and the Unabomber. And like I mentioned, the CIA, they chased Leary down to Alpert down to Mexico. The reports, you know, later which came available through the Freedom of Information Act. You know, one of the CIA reports said Leary and Alpert had set up, quote, an alleged happiness hotel, close quote, in Zihuatanejo. And when Ram Dass heard about that, he said, well, we should have hired the CIA as our press agent. And that would have been, that would have helped. But you know, the CIA, they thought LSD could be used as a chemical weapon for a while, sort of a weapon of mass distraction, sprayed on enemy troops as a truth serum. But both at Harvard and on the West Coast, I mean, Ken Kesey, where those whole scene was happening on the West Coast, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, I mean, Ken Kesey took LSD the first time at the VA hospital in Palo Alto, a government-sponsored research project. So people forget that LSD had a whole different reputation in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, it was legal until 1966, for one thing.
All right. Well, again, let's go to another caller, and this person is in Rantoul, I believe, line number 3. Hello.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick question, and I'll hang up. Is there much of a connection between Ram Dass and Sai Baba or Safi Sai Baba and some of those type individuals? And I'll just hang up.
You know, I'm not really sure about that, to tell you the truth. I think he did study with him or work with him, but I'm not sure. There's so many of these guys who popped up in the 60s, it's hard to keep them straight. But I'm sure I just can't answer that question.
All right. Well, we have maybe, again, about 5-6 minutes left. If someone would like to ask another question, we'll do our best to get them in. Our guest is Don Latton, and if you'd like to read more of the story that we've been talking about, you should look for his new book. The title is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, and it is published by Harper One. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing that actually I found quite interesting that I was not aware of is that there apparently is something of a rebirth of interest in psychedelic research and looking at medical applications. And in fact, there is something that I'm just now learning about called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And they're going to have a big conference in San Jose in April.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm also looking at the guest list of featured speakers. And here, who do I see on the list? Andy Weil.
Yeah.
He's apparently going to be participating.
That surprised me because he has not, you know, he basically kind of went mainstream, or the culture caught up with him, how you look at it. And he hasn't, he started out as a drug writer. I mean, his first few books were about drugs, The Natural Mind and From Chocolate to Morphine. And he only became, you know, the immensely popular and wealthy man that he is today when he, you know, sort of stopped talking about drugs and started talking about health and well-being. So it was good to see that he's still, you know, publicly associating himself with that movement, because you're right, there is a whole renaissance of research going on, and it's taken 50 years for people to recover from what Timothy Leary did. I mean, there was such a backlash against not just the street use of these drugs, but against a serious, you know, academic research into the beneficial uses of some of these drugs, and there are beneficial uses. If you know, under medical supervision and carefully controlled and all of that. And there's a whole range of research projects going on, and UC San Francisco, even at Harvard and in Canada and England. And so people are, it's just loosening up now. It's taken that long for us to recover from Leary.
And what sort of potential applications do people think there might be for psychedelics used with the, you know, essentially by prescription and with the work, with the cooperation and involvement of physicians
right,
and
right.
so forth?
Well, before Leary, I mean, most Americans heard of LSD the first time when a Hollywood gossip columnist had an interview with Cary Grant, who said that he was taking LSD with his therapist, which a lot of people were doing in the 50s. And he had a psychological breakthrough that would have taken him, as he put it, like 10 years of psychotherapy. And that's the way people were talking about this in the 50s. And that was all interrupted. And there's been a whole generation of kind of designer psychedelic drugs, which are less kind of overpowering and dangerous, actually, than psychologically dangerous than LSD. Drugs like MDMA, which is known as ecstasy. A lot of younger people were using that, you know, at least raves in the 1990s. But people have used that for post-traumatic, to work with people with post-traumatic stress disorder. Some people are using these drugs to treat cluster headaches. There was a lot of early research about treating alcoholism with psychedelic drugs, that people would have a kind of a spiritual or psychological breakthrough with the drugs that would help them uncover the root causes of their addiction. People are using, and actually this has been going on underground for quite a while, but it's starting to surface now. People have been using ecstasy, MDMA, for couples, with couples therapy, because it actually can produce incredible feelings of empathy and compassion. So there's all kinds of ways these drugs can be used if they're, you know, under proper medical supervision.
Now, we talked a little earlier about the psilocybin project that Leary and Alpert were involved in. One of the things that they did was they gave psilocybin to people who were in prison, and the idea was that this might turn them around. They could reassess their lives. They could decide, you know, they wanted to take a different direction. This would do something about recidivism. They wouldn't end up going back to jail. And so it had that sort of idea. And it seems that in that particular case, though, that it really didn't have that desired result.
Well, the problem with it was the Leary kind of fudged the data. What happened was they gave these drugs. The radical thing was that Leary and his graduate students, they took the drugs with the prisoners. They didn't just give them drugs. They took them with the prisoners and talked to them and counseled them and gave them all this attention, like a kind of a group therapy. And then after they got out of prison, they met with them for follow-ups and counseling. So it was impossible to know how much of that was the drug and how much of that was just all the attention that was devoted to these guys. You know, there wasn't a control group of people who didn't get the drug but got all the other counseling and help. So you really couldn't make any conclusions about the effect of the drug. And then some of the conclusions that they did make, someone went back, actually you mentioned MAPS, this organization, the leader of that, Rick Doblin, went back and checked the data and found a lot of problems with exaggerating the beneficial effects statistically. So, yeah, there were problems with that research project, but you know, that doesn't mean that it could have worked with the proper kind of controls and follow-up and long-term studies. But they were, you know, and Leary and Alpert were not allowed to continue that because they were kicked out of Harvard, for one thing. So.
We have some other callers. We'll try to get at least one or two. The next in line would be in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I just wonder what influenced Richard Schultes, that incredibly adventurous ethnobotanist in the jungles of the Amazon, had on these folks. So I'll hang up and listen.
Great question. Very much of an effect, especially on Andrew Weil. Richard Schultes was Andrew Weil's academic advisor. Weil was a botany major in his undergraduate years. His undergraduate thesis at Harvard was titled "The Uses of Nutmeg as a Psychotropic Agent." Schultes was very, very influential for Weil and a lot of these other early researchers, including this guy Gordon Wasson, who was kind of a freelance mushroom explorer himself. But yeah, no, he was very, very important in terms of Weil's giving Weil inspiration.
All right, and line three, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, this is extremely interesting, and I definitely congratulate you for looking into this, what a kind of contextualizing of the emphasis on drug usage and so forth in the Harvard milieu. One thing I was interested in is this influence of William James that you referred to briefly earlier. I study Buddhism, and I live and work in Japan a lot of the time. And one thing I've noticed in my study of Buddhism is that drugs and notions, let's say historically, of experience and so on, are simply absent. Typically, meditation and so forth is a ritual act of asceticism that people undergo in various ways. But really, there's no notion of experience. And so it seems a very American phenomenon in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And so I thought you might want to speak to that and to emphasize that Buddhism has actually no historical relationship with drug use. So I think it's something very important to take note of.
All right.
Right. Well, Buddhism doesn't, but of course Native American spirituality definitely does, which is the direction that kind of Weil went in, you know, with the Native American church and the peyote ceremonies and all of that. And, I mean, some people argue, I'm not sure, I'm not really qualified to speak on this, but some people argue that all religions, even Christianity, start out because of experiences people have taking some kinds of psychoactive plants, but that's kind of a wild theory. Not sure I hold it myself, but you mentioned this is so American, this way of looking at drugs and spirituality, and that's so right. I mean, Americans tend to be very practical and very utilitarian in our religion as well as in everything else, you know. And I think that's one reason that so many people would turn to drugs and consider it a spiritual or religious practice, because it was, it was such a practical way, a utilitarian way to have a mystical experience. Like I mentioned, I think that's not the real question here. The important question is how you bring that experience into your life, and how does it make you, you know, live your life as a more compassionate and aware person.
Yeah, we're just at the point where we're going to have to finish. I do have to ask you, because I watched a couple of talks that were on the web that you gave about the book, and mm-hmm. you told the same story twice, and I just want to know, is it a joke or not, where you talked about the rumor going around that there was acid on one of the pages of the book. was that your joke, or was that actual?
It's funny. That was a joke.
Okay.
You know, but
okay.
But at three of my first four book readings, people tried to turn me on. A woman tried to give me mushrooms at the first one. Someone tried to give me in San Francisco at a bookstore on Haight Street near Ashbury. A guy tried to give me four hits of blotter acid, and then at Harvard, someone tried to give me some ecstasy. So, and I don't do drugs anymore. I don't even drink anymore. So, I didn't take any of this. But it's mind blowing, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting story, so I would say if people, you want to read the story, look for the book. The title is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, and again, the subtitle is How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. The book is published by Harper One, which is a division of Harper Collins, and the author, our guest, Don Latin, and that's with two T's. He is well-known as a journalist who spent a lot of time writing about alternative and mainstream religious movements and figures in America. He wrote for a number of years for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covered the religion beat almost 20 years, and he's authored a number of books, and this is the new one. And Mr. Latin, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. That was fun.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
I'm University of Illinois Extension,
Department of Kinesiology and Community Health.
I'm United Way.
Christie Clinic,
Department of Communication, University of Illinois.
Family Resiliency Center.
I'm Unit 4.
The Urbana Free Library.
And I'm Molly Delaney of Illinois Public Media, and together we're CU Fit Families. Join us and many other organizations in fighting childhood obesity. Call 217-333-7300 or email delaney1@illinois.edu.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting What It Is, featuring Mavis Staples, Booker T, and J.J. Gray on March 30th. More information on this and other events can be found online at krannertcenter.com. Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets in Kansas City. May wheat now trading at 490 and three quarters, down 3 1/4. July, 502 down 3. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 482 and a quarter, down 4 1/4. July, 496 and three quarters.